just about everyone, but my name is Ken Saltus, and for the last couple of months now, I've been helping out, consulting at NACSW, working with the NACSW Educators Member Interest Group, and so I've gotten the chance to work with David Sherwood and Ed Coleman and Rick Hamiet's case and a number of other folks, and that's really been interesting and fun work. And so one of our projects that we're working on is a series of quarterly conference calls for social work educators. And so this is the first call in that series. And today's call, the format's going to be slightly different. We thought, in light of just some of the concerns and uncertainty about the new EPOS.
Michael, sure.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Just doing introductions here.
Okay. Well, there's a big echo. Is that?
Yeah, we're all listening.
Some of us are getting that.
We don't know the answer.
Just you, Michael.
So we thought in light of some of the concerns and hesitations about the new EPOS, we'd spend a bit of time today talking about issues around the integration of faith and or spirituality and social work education and how that sort of fits with the new EPOS. So our plan today is a little different than where it'll be in the future, where I'm going to be our first presenter. I won't be presenting each time. We're going to recruit some of you to present. But I'll be presenting something that I'm doing now in class, and then David Sherwood is a member of the COA, and Ed Coleman as a department chair who's who's writing under the new EPOS, the 2008 EPOS for Eastern University. They're going to be giving me some feedback about perhaps some ways that my faith integration strategy fits with the 2008 EPOS, some ways it might be adapted to fit even better, and we're just going to have sort of some dialogue about that. Before we go any further, I thought it might be good to do some other introductions, and I think Rick Hamiet's case was going to introduce himself, and Michael Schur, I think, was going to introduce himself. And Michael, did you get my email?
I just read it. I was writing, and I lost track of time, so I read it 2 seconds ago. Yes.
Do you mind making that announcement then?
I can share a little bit, sure.
Okay, great. So Rick and then Michael.
Okay. Rick Hamiet's case. I'm actually calling from LaGuardia Airport, picking up my daughter who's coming home for a weekend, so I'm feeling in a particularly good mood, but delighted to be in on the call as well. Just a 15-second commercial. This call and this type of project of trying to drill down and provide much more concrete strategies and examples of ways that integration can be brought into the work that we do is something that NACSW wants to do for educators, for practitioners. But our hope is to bridge a lot of the theoretical talk that we have about integrating faith and practice and taking some of the best, very concrete ways that people are living that out and sharing that and refining that and honing that. So we're pretty excited that this is sort of our flagship attempt to move in that direction. So thank you to you all for participating and Ken for leading that charge. Let me just say one other housekeeping thing. Probably because of the echo, once we're done with introductions, when Ken begins some of his presentation, I'll probably just mute you all out because I'm pretty sure that'll take care of the echo effect. And then as Ken is ready to facilitate more discussion, I'll unmute things. But at least for those of us who are finding the echoing annoying, I'm pretty sure that'll take care of it. Plus, if you have a dog or a baby in your office or in your living room, the rest of us won't have a chance to meet them. But again, on behalf of NACSW, just delighted that you're all able to join us today.
Thanks. And Michael Schur?
Yes. Well, we're in the process of putting together a project that we're calling an integration of faith and learning or spirituality and faith and learning curriculum modules for social work. And we'll probably have a call for papers sometime in June, and I think we have our first steering committee meeting coming up in a few weeks. And the idea for this project is to invite people from across the country, from different backgrounds and different Christian denominations and schools, differences, to share with us the innovative things that they're doing to integrate faith and spirituality into all parts of the curriculum. And we created a template so that they can do that in a way that fits with core competencies, and as those are peer reviewed and accepted, they'll be posted either on the bulletin board or the wiki board, and then eventually We see us putting together handbooks that will be useful and being able to be purchased.
And so we're hoping that some of you might want to present on these types of conference calls, develop your presentation into a module for inclusion in the resource book that Michael is working on.
And it's really not just—it's not me in name. I'm just sort of chairing it, but it's something that's going to be published by NACSW, and each of us would be recognized as an editor. But I wouldn't say that it's my project.
Okay.
It's our association's project.
Right. Great. Thank you. Could we take just a moment and go around and have the other participants, if you could introduce yourselves, and if there's anything in particular that you'd like to get out of the call today, in a sentence or a short blurb. So just jump in when there's an empty space there.
Ed Kuhlman, Eastern University.
Sandy Bauer, Eastern.
Right across the hall.
Jane Hoyt Oliver, Malone University.
Christine Palmer, Cedarville University.
Phyllis Yeri,
Cedarville University.
Stacy Barker, Eastern Nazarene College.
And Jim Vanderwerd, Redeemer University.
And David Sherwood.
And this is Blake Jones, University of Kentucky in Lexington.
Okay, hearing no one else, I'm going to move on then. The only other housekeeping information is that I had emailed out on the NACSW listserv yesterday, and Rick has also, I think, sent an email out to this effect. I'm going to be reviewing some documents, and those are posted on the NACSW website. We have a link to those. If you haven't gotten that link and you would like to have the documents so that you can sort of look at them in real time as I'm going through them, if you will send an email to my administrative assistant, Becky Albertson. Her email is B Albertson. It's BALBERTSON at Malone, MALONE dot EDU. She'll send you a link to the documents that we're going to be talking about. Does anybody need me to repeat that email address?
Ken, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Will you also be showing us a little bit more about how to fill out for the bulletin board? I went on there, and I'm not quite sure what to do on there.
Yeah, you know, I'm still figuring that one out as well. That was sort of a late-breaking thing. But I think before we go, I don't know, Rick, do you have any comments on that one?
Do we want to wait on that?
Probably in the wrap-up, the last 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the things we want to do to keep this discussion going. And that would be a natural time to talk a little bit about the technology and how to use it.
Okay, thanks.
Great. And remind me to do that before we go, if I forget. Okay, well, the faith integration strategy I'm going to work on, I'm going to sort of go over today, this is something that in the past I've used in our Introduction to Social Work course here at Malone. In the past couple of years, we hired a wonderful new professor, and we've sort of switched courses around. And so I'm no longer teaching that course, and so I'm in the process of trying to adapt this to use in our first practice skills course. And I really want to use it to frame social work practice as an opportunity to really live out the gospel of Christ's kingdom and to live out this idea of shalom that I'm going to be talking about today. And so this came about for me, and I should say, too, that this strategy is something that hasn't always been presented in as linear of a fashion as I'm going to do it today. It's often sort of emerged in conversations with students. So I've tried to present it in a linear fashion, but it is sort of a work in progress. And so just sort of keep that in mind as I'm talking about it. And this conversation with students started early on in my teaching here at Malone when I had students in our Introduction to Social Work class make comments to the effect of, well, Ken, it's great that you've told us about how social workers help to alleviate mental health symptoms and deal with addiction and provide food and shelter for the poor, but what does that really matter if they die and go to hell and if they don't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? And how does that, is this really something, is this social work really something that we as Christians should be caring about, should be doing? How does this fit with our faith? And so in wrestling through that, I started to work on this idea of helping the students to re-examine the idea of what the gospel is all about, and especially and some of this comes from my Anabaptist perspective, to look at the gospel the way that Jesus talked about the gospel, to really, you know, focus on thinking about this the way that Jesus seemed to think about it. And so to do that, one of the things that's helpful is to go over some questions and to give the students some questions to sort of wrestle through. And this would be the first sheet. If you're linked to the document on the website, this would be the first sheet, the part where it says discussion questions. And you could have these done as homework, or you could have students in small groups at the beginning of the class looking at these. And the first thing that I usually do in this discussion is just ask students to define the gospel. What is the gospel? What does that mean to you? And where does this definition come from? And almost 100% of the time, students will say something to me like, the gospel means Jesus died on the cross for my sins. And my aim here is not to change their view of that, because obviously I believe that and I'm all for that, but my view is to try to help them to realize that this is a bit of a truncated version of the gospel, and it's really not one that Jesus himself taught. And so this view of the gospel suggests that service to others is helpful only if it leads to a conversion experience. And this is sort of where my students are coming from. If the only thing that matters is converting and becoming a Christian, then again, you know, social work itself is sort of suspect in the minds of my students. And my concern about this is that this gospel de-emphasizes and possibly even negates much of Jesus' life and ministry. It focuses just on his death. And so one of the things I do to start trying to have a conversation around this is to have the students read Matthew 11, verses 2 through 6. And in this passage, Jesus talks about, he uses the term good news. And this is the same phrase in Greek that we translate gospel. A lot of versions don't use that term in this translation, but it is the same Greek word. One of the things I try to get them to think about is, how does Jesus use this term gospel to mean more than Jesus dying on the cross for our sins? Because at this point, Jesus is still alive, and it's pretty clear that not even the disciples, not even his closest followers, really understand yet this whole idea of the death on the cross and substitutionary atonement or penal substitution. You know, that this isn't sort of part of the conversation yet. And so just to give a quick overview of this passage in case you haven't read it or don't have a Bible in front of you, this is the passage where John the Baptizer is in prison. He's been imprisoned, and he sends his disciples to Jesus to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we expect another? And Jesus' response here is really interesting. He goes back, he says, go back and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news, or the gospel, is preached to the poor. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me. And of course, this statement links to all kinds of Old Testament concepts about ideas of shalom and the year of Jubilee that we're going to discuss more in a minute. So usually, you know, I sort of get the students to start thinking about this as we discuss this question, and then I come back to it in a mini-lecture later on in the lesson or in the class. So in this passage, Jesus states that the gospel has been preached to the poor, despite the fact that Jesus has yet to die on the cross. And so this is the first part of getting my students to think about this, that, wow, if the gospel just means Jesus died on the cross for my sins, how can Jesus say the gospel has been preached to the poor when he hasn't died on the cross for my sins yet? And so obviously Jesus is seeing the gospel in a larger picture than just the death on the cross, that there's more to it than that. And so this is sort of my first step in trying to lead the students towards what Ron Sider describes as a balanced gospel in his book, Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience. Ron Sider talks about this and says, you know, we need to have a balanced gospel that looks at the death on the cross and the sacrificial atonement, but also looks at Jesus' life and ministry and his ethics and how he lived. So I'm trying to sort of get the students to broaden their idea of what the gospel is and what that means. And so a follow-up question I ask then to the Matthew 11 passage is to ask the students to think about the identity of the groups that Jesus uses to establish himself as Messiah. And what's significant about these groups, the poor, the deaf, the lepers, the lame, the blind? You know, why does Jesus talk about these groups, and what's significant about them? And one of the things that start to emerge during this discussion is that these were the groups in Jesus' day that were disenfranchised and marginalized, and these were the people who were sort of outside the circle of acceptance in Jewish society. For instance, lepers were unclean, and most of us know that in Jesus' day, if you were unclean, you were kept outside the city gates, you were kept sort of quarantined, you were untouchable. And so these were the people that really, you know, you couldn't interact with and maintain your social standing or your religious standing. And some of the other groups, this isn't perhaps as readily apparent, but we know, for instance, that in John, when the disciples see a blind man, they ask, who sinned, him or his parents? So again, there's this idea that if you are in some way physically disabled, there's some sort of sin involved in that, and that somehow makes you less than the rest of us. And so one of the things I do in class when we talk about this is to ask the students to think, who would these groups be today? You know, we're not, you know, we're pretty inclusive anymore about disabilities, although at least in language we are, sometimes not in practice. Leprosy isn't a big concern in America, but who are the groups that are sort of outside of the scope of acceptance in our society? And just again, to sort of try to bring this into the here and now for the students, how does this work out today? So usually after we have a discussion about those three discussion questions, what I do then is I move to more of a mini-lecture, and I've included a PowerPoint of some of the things I try to talk about in this mini-lecture. I'm not a big fan of PowerPoint, but I thought this would sort of summarize it nicely. So what I'm going to do is just go over, I'm going to try to move through this pretty quickly, probably more quickly than I would with the students, to make sure that we have time for discussion. But what I try to do is help the students to move, again, broaden their understanding of the gospel, and to try to use these ideas of the kingdom of God as a current reality, a present reality that's breaking forth into the world. And Jesus talks about the kingdom this way. He says, you know, it's a mustard seed, it's small, but it's growing, it's becoming fully formed, but it's not there yet. Trying to help them to understand the gospel as being a story about the kingdom breaking out in the current world, in our current time, and as a story about shalom. And so I try to use this idea of shalom and set this up as a key hermeneutic or a key principle for understanding the Christian story. And so the way that that works is I usually ask them, what does shalom mean? And someone invariably says peace, because that's how we've usually translated shalom. Unfortunately, peace doesn't mean a lot to my students. They often think of peace as the absence of conflict or the absence of violence. And in biblical times, the biblical writers would have had a much more broad understanding of shalom. And they would have thought of shalom as a situation characterized by harmony between God, humans, and all of creation. And so I try to start off with that, this idea of shalom writ large. And so then I try to frame the biblical story of the Christian faith in terms of shalom and to retell the story with an emphasis on shalom. And so we can start in the Garden of Eden, right after creation, where we have a situation that exemplifies shalom. Adam and Eve have this intimate connection with each other. Adam and Eve enjoy direct connection with God. God comes and walks in the garden with them and talks directly with them. They are connected with the world around them, with creation. They name the animals. There's just this picture of harmony among people, God, and creation. And then, of course, we all know the story. What happens next is the fall, and humans break. Their harmony with God is broken to the point where God curses humanity and talks about pain in childbirth and bringing forth food from the ground with great labor and toil. And, you know, there's this lack of connection and this separation that humans have to leave the garden. And so this harmony is broken. The harmony is also broken between humans and other humans. Adam and Eve are no longer quite as intimately connected as they once were. We see the beginning of patriarchy, and we see Eve being subject to Adam. And I want to be clear here that when I teach this, I don't teach that patriarchy is the plan or that is the norm for today. And in fact, I make the comment often that the redeemed are no longer subject to the curse. We've been released from the curse. And so I don't use this as a groundwork to sort of, or a framework to talk about submission in marriage or anything like that, but I just talk about this as the beginning of a power differential between men and women. And then we also see this harmony with nature and with creation lost. All of a sudden, animals, they need to be killed and skinned for clothing, and the ground no longer yields food without toil. And so we see this loss of the harmony that existed in the beginning. And then we move on through the story in the Old Testament, and we see that there are hints of shalom. We see shalom hinted at in the Old Testament law and the prophets. And just one example of that, the idea of the year of Jubilee, the situation that was required in the Mosaic law, where every 49 years, every 50th year actually, the Israelites were supposed to return all land to its original owner, slaves were supposed to be set free, debts were supposed to be forgiven. And the whole idea here is that we promote right relationships among people, and that the people of God are supposed to be people who live in harmony, where we don't have one person who's sort of hoarding wealth or hoarding money or hoarding slaves or in some way exercising power over other people, but that we're redistributing at least every 50 years, and that in some way this promotes, or this at least offers us a small glimpse of the harmony that was supposed to be there from the beginning. And of course, there's many other examples, the prophets and their call for justice. You know, this is a call for harmony among different social classes, different groups of people. And so I try to talk to my students about the Old Testament as being a hint or a small sort of glimmer of shalom after the fall. And then we start to move into the New Testament, and we talk about Jesus as embodying and exemplifying shalom. And so a good place to start with this is the Magnificat, or Mary's song, from Luke 1. And I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but I've highlighted in the document that I sent out, I've highlighted a passage that sort of, you know, it's a shalom sort of passage. And that passage reads as follows. It says, "He, meaning God, has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty." So again, we see this leveling out, this idea that there's not going to be a hierarchy, that the work God is doing brings about justice, it brings about this harmony between people, and so we're not going to have one person with a lot while someone else is hungry, but we're actually going to flip the script, and we're going to sort of turn the world upside down and turn the hierarchy upside down, and that this, again, this is a testimony to shalom, this idea that we need to live in harmony in this way. And then moving on into Jesus' life and ministry, Jesus declares a kingdom. And if you read the Gospels closely, this is what got Jesus crucified. This is what was hung around his neck or hung at the top of the cross, right? It's this idea that this is Jesus, King of the Jews. And so an Anabaptist or a Mennonite reading of this, and John Howard Yoder is a good example of this, he would say that this kingdom that Jesus declared, that this was a reality. This wasn't just sort of language or rhetoric on Jesus' part, but that Jesus was really serious about proclaiming a kingdom, and that this kingdom was a threat to the Roman Empire and to the Jewish religious hierarchy, but it wasn't a kingdom the way that we would typically think about a kingdom. It was a kingdom characterized by shalom. For example, the bringing in of disenfranchised groups, of lepers, women, disabled individuals, Gentiles, people labeled as sinners. So this wasn't a kingdom that was built on keeping people down. Most kingdoms are built on power and control and stratification. This was a kingdom that was an inclusive kingdom where all had sort of equal access. An alternative reading of the story is that when Jesus talks about the kingdom, he's really serious, and he's declaring a kingdom that's supposed to present a normative way of life for us today. Another theologian, Walter Wink, talks about Christ's kingdom as an entity that unmasks what he calls the domination system. And he talks about the domination system as the powers that be or the status quo. And in these passages, he links to the powers and principalities language that Paul often uses and says, when we're talking about powers and principalities, yes, we're talking about demons, but we're really talking about this power structure. And he says that power structures have both an internal spiritual side and also an external physical side. So he says, you know, when Jesus is talking about this, talking about the kingdom, he's talking about a kingdom that encounters the powers in a different way. And so he would say that the Roman Empire, there's both a spiritual and a physical aspect to the domination system of the Roman Empire. And Wendt goes on to say that in the New Testament, when we're reading the Greek words that are translated world or that are translated flesh, and that would be cosmos in Greek for world and sarx for flesh, that we should really read the word domination system into that, that these are the principalities and powers that are sort of controlling the present age. And Wink would say that, you know, for instance, when we read the passage where Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world," when he says that in John 18, we should actually read this as Jesus saying, "My kingdom is not part of this domination system. My kingdom isn't run the way that other kingdoms are run. My kingdom's run on these principles of shared power and inclusion and harmony of shalom." So we talk a bit about that, about sort of the political reality of Christ's kingdom. And then we talk a little bit about Jesus' religious context, the world that Jesus lived in as a Jewish male. And a good example of this, obviously it's hard to do justice to that in a few minutes in a social work class, but we talk about Jewish temple worship in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' life and death. And I've included in my PowerPoints a document of the Jewish temple. Now, on the printout, it's sort of small. If you're on the computer, you might be able to blow it up. But what's significant here is that Jesus lived in a context where there was a very high level of stratification, a very high level of hierarchy, where depending on who you were, that sort of determined on how close you could get to God and how religiously orthodox you could be. And so if you were to enter the what's called the Second Temple at the time of Jesus, the first thing you got to was the court of the Gentiles. And if you were a Gentile, you could go no further than that. You couldn't get any closer to the holy place at the center of the temple. If you were a Jewish woman, you could go one step further and you could enter the court of the women. If you were a Jewish male, you could go one step further and enter what was called the court of the Israelites. If you were a priest, you could go one step further and enter the court of priests. And then if you were the chief priest, you could enter the Holy of Holies, or this holy place in the center of the temple, once a year to make a sacrifice and sort of atone for the sins of your people. And that was where the presence of God was thought to dwell. And so you can see that in Jewish religious life, access to God was seen as tightly controlled, and your position in society sort of determined how close you could get to God. And so again, for Jesus to be walking the earth and to be touching lepers and to be talking to women and to be spending time with Gentiles and sinners, this was a radical thing. And it speaks again to this idea of shalom, of harmony between people and among groups and between people and God. And a lot of times, you know, if we've grown up in the church, we've sort of missed all that. We don't really understand how radical it was for Jesus to talk to a woman, or to allow a woman with the issue of blood to touch him, or to talk to a Gentile. And so, again, trying to get into the students' minds that when Jesus is talking about the gospel, he's talking about this idea of a very inclusive version of shalom that allows people who were formerly alienated and disconnected to be in harmony with each other and with God. And so I have a slide where, you know, I mentioned that Christ's kingdom confronted hierarchy and exclusion of the domination system by including women, Gentiles, disabled, lepers, poor, unclean, sinners, people with all these labels. And just an example, you know, sometimes students will say, well, where else is this talked about in the Bible? One example of that is in Galatians 3, verse 28, where, you know, that passage says, "There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, you are all one in Christ." And so just making this point that this wasn't just something Jesus talked about, but this idea of shalom, this idea of inclusion and harmony, was something that other New Testament writers addressed as well. And so then I usually end that mini-lecture sort of talking about what are some links between the kingdom and between social work. How can social work testify to the present reality of Christ's kingdom? And we talk about some micro examples. How can we do that when we're working one-on-one with individuals and small groups and families? You know, how do we sort of live out the reality of this kingdom now? And how does that testify to the gospel, even if we're not proselytizing, even if we're not trying to convert people? Then we also look at some macro examples. How does doing societal level or community level or organizational level work? How does that testify to the reality of Christ's kingdom? And, you know, if we're creating some sort of a more just society, You know, isn't that a witness to the gospel, the good news that shalom is coming back into the world through Christ? And then we also talk a bit about some areas of potential conflict between social work and Christ's kingdom. And just one example of the kind of conversation we have there, we talk a bit usually about Constantinianism, this idea that the Roman Empire was very hostile to Christianity for the first 300 years of Christianity's existence. And what really turned the table on that was when the Emperor Constantine became a Christian. And, you know, he saw a vision of a cross in the sky, and it said, by this sign, conquer, and went into battle and won. And contrary to popular belief, Constantine didn't become a Christian then, but prior to the end of his life, near the end of his life, he did convert to Christianity. And about this time, all of a sudden, Christianity became the state religion. So Christianity went from being this radical, countercultural sort of faith and new way of looking at the kingdom and of power, to all of a sudden being closely aligned with the power structures of the day. And a lot of us have some real concerns about that. What happened at that point was that all of a sudden Christianity was co-opted. And so whereas for the first 300 years of Christianity, the church leaders would tell people that you shouldn't serve in the military, Christians shouldn't kill, all of a sudden you had to be a Christian to serve in the Roman military. There became a point where there was a conversion test, and you actually couldn't kill people without being a Christian. And so one of the things that we talk about in class is that when Christianity and the state become closely aligned, oftentimes the good news of the kingdom is lost. And so a lot of people say that the reason students like mine have ended up with this very truncated version of the gospel, which is all about internal spirituality and personal salvation, is that that's sort of all that's left after the Roman Empire co-opted Christianity and sort of took away the good news of this idea of shalom and of Christians giving up power and living in harmony. And that's a sort of a controversial type of thing, and I know not all of my Christian brothers and sisters agree with that, but this is the sort of conversation that we often have in class at the end of this discussion. You know, and we also talk about some other dangers in or some other points of conflict between social work and the kingdom. And so, you know, to end that conversation, you know, I try to go back to Sider's idea of a balanced gospel, and we talk about how Christ's life and death reestablish shalom, and they certainly establish a harmonious relationship between God and humans. And so this fits with what our students have often been taught, that, you know, by believing in Christ, I'm made right with God. And I totally affirm that, and I make it very clear to the students that I'm not cutting that out of the gospel. But I want to add this other part, that Christ's life and death reestablish shalom between people, reestablish harmonious relationships between individuals and between groups of people. And, you know, so that's usually sort of what happens during the course of the mini-lecture that's described in the PowerPoint slides that I distributed. And yeah, so then we sort of come to the end of class or the end of the discussion, and you know, one thing that could be done here would be to have the students read something from Walter Wenck, to read about in his book Engaging the Powers, he has a chapter on God's domination, free order, Jesus and God's reign. That's chapter 6. And so that would be something that you could have students read as sort of a follow-up to reinforce this idea of shalom and the gospel as being the inbreaking of shalom in the world and a new way of living, a new kingdom within the world, a new power structure, and a new way of relating to the current power structures. And I also try really hard to emphasize to the students that the kingdom is a present reality, but it's not fully developed yet. And we can't bring about the kingdom through our work. There's a danger that students who really buy into this will say, wow, you know, I can be a social worker and I can change the world and I can bring about Christ's kingdom. And that, in my view, is really the fallacy of liberal theology, this idea that human progress brings about the kingdom. And I don't believe that. I don't teach that. Rather, what I try to get our students to understand and to see is that our work as social workers testifies to the reality of the current kingdom, and it points expectantly to the future consummation of Christ's kingdom when he returns and returns to earth and sets up this new kingdom in its fullness. So I try to point out to our students that what we're doing as social workers just hints at this reality that's already present. It's a mustard seed, it's small, it's growing, and it points to the greater reality that Christ is coming back to finally set all this up at the end of time. So that's a little bit of what I try to do with students around this issue. And I see it's about 20 of. So I think that the next step here would be to have David and Ed comment a bit on the strategy and how it fits with the 2008 EPAS. And then we'll just have some other dialogue and questions and comments as they arise.
Okay. Before I jump in, though, I'd be interested to see if anyone just had any initial reactions to what Ken has presented. Any reactions, observations? Is this something that sounds like you've done or you might do? Or
I would just comment that I would love to see this kind of introduction for students in social work in every Christian program around the country. I just think it's fantastic.
This is Jim. Yeah, I think it's great, Ken. I think you present it well, and it's entirely consistent with the kinds of things that we do in our program and that I've done in my own teaching in various forms and ways. And I think one of the key challenges that you've identified is getting students in social work who are motivated by this sort of sense of compassion and so on to think of the gospel beyond the individual. And maybe the one thing that and you probably get to this elsewhere, but that also reflects sort of this sort of small L liberal perspective, you know, that humanist.
Right.
Where we've taken the gospel and interpreted it in the context of our culture and made it about me, you know, and not, you know, so I like that. I think it's great. And I see this being very amenable to adapting for a variety of courses, actually. And then taking those threads and running with them as you get into more advanced courses and so on. So I think it's great.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay, well, one of the things, again, I'm going to focus a little bit since of my past and now, again, current role as being a commissioner on the Commission on Accreditation, kind of looking at it from the crediting eyes, and especially in terms of the 2008 EPAS. But one of the themes that leaps out to me real quickly that relates very strongly to the new version of the EPAS is the idea of context. And that's a word that's used a lot and is made a very prominent part of the new accreditation standards. And, you know, this to me is a great example. What Ken has done is a great example of responding to context and, you know, developing a teaching strategy that is very sensitive to the particular context, and in this case, the students who come into the classroom, and what are their, what kind of beliefs and expectations, and how does that become part of how to help them understand what it means to be a social worker and a Christian. And, you know, to have a holistic understanding. So to me, it's a very context-sensitive strategy. And I would, you know, take it one step further in that theme, in the idea that, you know, obviously he's coming from, and that a lot of the terminology and a lot of the citations are from Anabaptist theological background. And that, again, is very context relevant or specific perhaps. And I was just wondering or guessing that maybe someone like Jim Vanderwaard or someone else who might come from a slightly different theological perspective might work with the same idea but perhaps might use some cites in different readings or maybe slightly different language. I was just wondering, Jim, did anything come to your mind along that line?
Yeah, that's a good point, David. I mean, one of the things I started doing is just sort of making a list of additional sort of what I would view as being complementary kinds of citations and so on. And I'm familiar with the ones that that Ken cited, but I actually like this part because it, you know, to be able to richly borrow from various Christian streams of thought mm-hmm. is excellent. And you know, I mean, in our, certainly in our university, it's primarily sort of neo-Calvinist Reformed, but we get students from all over the place, and so it puts me on my toes. I can't sit there and invoke a bunch of denominational jargon. I can get away with that. So I have to be able to translate that into language that's sensitive to a variety of traditions, and that's why I think this is great. I mean, one of the things that we might do as a next step is just to share some additional things that, in terms of citations that we each maybe are familiar with that we think are complementary.
Mm-hmm. Great. Anyway, one of the things, and I don't want to take up too much of the time here, but just going to make a couple comments or observations about how, first of all, the overall idea of integrating faith and learning fits into the 2008 EPOS, you know, kind of where and how. And because that's, some of you maybe have not gotten that familiar with it yet, but I guess I would make this recommendation, even if you're not coming up for accreditation soon, or if you are, but if you're still going to be writing under the 2001 EPAT, you really need to be thinking in terms of the 2008, even though technically you're under the 2001, just in terms of the overall perspective. But on the one hand, I think with the 2008 standards, there's no one place that specifically names religion and spirituality per se, you know, as something that must be in the curriculum. Because one of the big differences with the new standards is not specifying content directly. We don't have the 6 or 8 content areas laid out the way it has been for a number of years. On the other hand, I would argue that there's a very strong and very plausible connection of integrating faith and learning and spirituality and religion, connecting with several of the core competencies, as they're called, under the new EPAT. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but this is under EP 2.1, and there's a whole series of these, and several of them are ones that will sound familiar to you because this goes back to the kinds of under the current or the previous EPAT was called objectives, and you had to develop objectives related to this. Well, now you have to develop competencies. So things like ethical principles, critical thinking, engaging diversity and difference practice, advancing human rights and social and economic justice, applying knowledge of human behavior and social environment, responding to contexts that shape practice, and the whole series of engage, assess, intervene, and evaluate, the helping problem-solving model. So I think all of these are places where strategies like Ken's could be very plausibly connected, and other strategies kind of like these. So one of the things that's required under the new EPAS is that you can't just state these broad objectives and so forth or competencies, but in order that you have to operationalize them. So you take, what do you mean by engaging diversity and difference? How do you operationalize that into practice? What would that look like in practice competency? What are some of the things people should be able to know or value or do in order to engage diversity and difference? And clearly, dealing with spirituality and religion in an ethical and appropriate way is one of those kinds of things.
David, can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm just curious because we're going through this each Monday. How would Ken create a rubric to measure this competence from this lesson or this unit?
Well, that's a very important question, and I don't know that I have the answer today. but that, in fact, that was one of my points later on, that what you would need to do if you're looking at a strategy like this one is think in terms of what is the competency, what should students be able to think, value, or do as a result of this, and how would you measure it? You know, what are activities, you know, so on the one hand, first step, what are some of the, you know, discussions, lectures, content, activities, so forth, that could support this competency? And then what are some of the ways you could know whether the students were able to actually put that into practice? So that is a key underlying theme, and I don't have the specific answer to that. If we had time in a few minutes, maybe we could brainstorm on that.
Sure.
But in the light of time, I'm going to move quickly ahead because I want to give Ed a chance to jump in as well. So I've made the case that this kind of thing can be connected to a number of the core competencies under the new EPAS. In addition, as under the 2001 standards, but even more so under the 2008, programs are encouraged to add additional program-related competencies. So you get this basic 10 or so. But I would argue that every social work program, certainly in a Christian college and university, takes its identity seriously, should at least include one competency in addition to the 10 in the handbook that addresses developing competency to deal appropriately with spirituality and religion. And probably speaking directly to Christian faith, an ethical, competent practice. Whether they have an additional program-related competency, I would say that all social work programs, like at the University of Kentucky or anywhere, should be including in their operationalizing of their competencies components that develop ability to deal appropriately with spirituality and religion, both on the part of how the social worker, Christian or not, handles their own beliefs and how they impact how they perceive and act, and also how they develop the ability to understand and appropriately utilize the client's beliefs and practices. So I think that's a mandate on all social work programs, Christian or not. And that, you know, may probably not in public programs or state programs necessarily develop one of these additional specific competencies, but I would argue that programs, Christian colleges and universities should have at least one additional competency in their list that relates to this issue. Thinking about Ken's strategy just very superficially, if you ask the question, where does this fit on the, to think of knowledge, values, or skills, probably as it's presented, it, in my mind, it's probably focusing more on knowledge and values than it is skill per se. But it could be developed into a skill component as well. So then the question that Michael raised earlier, what would assessment look like? What would it mean to have competency? For example, Christian students who could understand their social work practice as not just evangelism, but that, you know, demonstration of the gospel is an important part of that. But and what kinds of educational strategies could you use to develop this or to assess it? And I, you know, quick, and I'll stop here. If you wanted to assess students' ability to implement some of this kind of stuff, I would think things like cases, use of cases. They could be writing about them, or they could be engaged in role-play scenarios that dealt with these kinds of integration issues, for children religion issues, and that kind of thing. But I'm going to stop here.
Okay, Ed, did you have any comments or anything to add as far as connection to the EPAS adaptation for the 2008 EPAS?
Did we lose Ed?
I wonder.
I can walk across the hall.
I might have to leave in a couple minutes, too.
Okay, well.
He's talking, but I don't hear. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Do you want to go over and talk online? Ken, while Sandy's checking in on Ed, can I raise one question?
Sure.
This is partly for Blake, but also for other folks who are looking at this series of teaching in non-Christian colleges. Have you done some thinking about how a strategy like this might be reframed, recast, So it could in some way be adapted for use in a setting where, again, the mission of the college is not necessarily the integration of Christian faith and social work practice.
I do have two thoughts on that, and one's a bit more formal and one's more informal. So with the more formal classroom-based one first, you know, it seems to me with the work, the great amount of work that's been done in the last 15 years or so about the importance of spirituality and religion in social work practice and the practice of other types of human services, it seems to me that understanding, how a certain faith tradition would look at charitable work and link that to the key aspects of the faith tradition could be helpful. So if you're someone in a secular social work program that isn't particularly interested in faith yourself, but you may you may be working in an area where, you know, oftentimes we know that there may be people of faith who are, you know, working with us, or we may be supervising, to understand how a particular faith tradition might conceptualize the fit between social work and that faith tradition. It seems to me that could be helpful, and so something like this could be used as sort of a case study or example of, you know, here's one reason that people from the Christian faith tradition might be interested in social work, and that might even play out in a history of social welfare or history of social work sort of class where, you know, when we're talking about the Judeo-Christian origins of social work, you might sort of talk about this, because sometimes, as many of us know, there's been sort of this divide between Christianity and social work, and so I think using this sort of strategy, you know, that might be a part of bridging that divide or a discussion starter. I do think it might not be appropriate to sort of cover all this in a non-sectarian setting, but maybe even using a few key components of it, you know, to sort of summarize the idea of shalom and to say that this has been an impetus for many, many Christians to become and practice social work. So that would be one thought I had. Another thought I had was, just going back to my own days as an MSW student, I had sort of this crisis of faith in social work, which I guess is the thing to have a crisis of faith in if you're going to have one. But I was in my first year of my MSW studies and really wrestling with this idea of, should I have gone to seminary instead? You know, should I be doing more explicitly Christian work? And I wrote about this in a log or a journal or something that I had to turn in. And my professor, who was not a person of faith, actually came to me and talked this through and said, no, I think what you're talking about fits very well with social work. She didn't, you know, infringe on my self-determination at all, but said, you know, I think you can do this from a Christian point of view, even though that's not a point of view I have. And so I think, you know, even, you know, and I'm thinking, for instance, in a religiously conservative area like the southern part of the United States, you know, for social work professors to have access to this sort of thing, to sit down with students and say, wow, I hear that you're seeing some conflict here, but here's a way that, you know, we've talked about that there could be some, you know, some bridging concepts between Christianity and social work. So anyway, those are a couple of my thoughts about how that could work.
Just real quickly, Blake, any initial thoughts or reactions to some of what Ken's sharing here? Blake, are you still on?
I want to say again that I thought it's very good stuff and very, very useful. And, you know, I like everything would need a lot of adaptation in different settings, but you know, I think it's very a very good example of a strategy. And I also think that it's very amenable to adaptation to the new accreditation standards.
One of the concerns I have at maybe a secular school, and I actually brought this up when we thought about our competencies here, is are we competent to do that? For instance, one thing to present for me, as I understand and go in depth about the Christian gospel, but to then to do that in the same depth with every other possible diversity, religion, and then how to demonstrate competence for a student to be able to sort of demonstrate that they get the depth of each of these other religious influences on charity work. That would, I mean, it sounds good, but I don't. How could that be covered in a class? In a HPSI or in a social work course, while also studying, covering other things? Or is it better to be covered you know, in an elective religious course, or we wrestled with that here, but who of us are actually competent to teach every other possible world religion and how it's related to their charitable influences, and so that each gets its same depth?
Yeah. It's a good question, and I don't have the answer to that. One thought would be, it reminds me of some of the turmoil I go through when I'm teaching about diversity issues, that, you know, I can't talk about every type of diversity with equal, you know, equal emphasis or equal time allotted to it. And so what we often do is use a couple different areas of diversity as an example. And we might choose, you know, at least in my classes, we might choose one, you know, one racial or ethnic group to sort of use as an example of how diversity affects them and sort of is a lens through which they see the world, how to practice effectively with people from that group. We, you know, we may talk a bit about sexual orientation or ability level. And so it seems like we can never really do justice to everything in this area or in a lot of others, which again, doesn't answer the question, but I think sometimes the best we can do is to give a couple good examples and to say you've got to, when you're working with someone from a specific tradition or a specific group, you've really got to do the hard work of finding out about that group. And you can do that inductively by talking to people from the group.
Yeah, I really like what you said about the informal methods. I think faculty in schools of social work, regardless of setting, should need to be able to talk to students in a way that helps them learn and journey for themselves and then learn how to impact and teach them. I don't know if I could do it, like at a secular school, and then do it in a way that students or colleagues didn't think that I was trying to infuse or bias them in a certain way.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't teach it in the same way in a secular school. That's right.
Sure.
But I think everywhere we need, and there's always going to have to be selectivity.
Right.
You know, and this is true with every area of the content.
Right.
I mean, the content that potentially every social worker ought to know is just beyond, you know, belief. So it's always selective. So I think one of the basic strategies is you have to equip students with the tools to be able to, and, you know, the cognitive tools, contextual concepts and so forth, so that they can then get the specific knowledge that they need for their specific population they encounter in practice and so forth. So I don't think it's required that you cover every possible iteration in the same depth, but I do think it is possible to help students develop abilities to understand and to get the information the specific information they need.
And David, you just used the phrase contextual, and that brings us back to the core competency that emphasizes context.
Right.
And I'm not sure that at a Christian institute, I think that the agenda is longer, perhaps for people who are teaching at secular schools and have a whole array of
that's what I'm saying
stuff that they have to deal with.
Right. That was my point.
Yeah.
This is Jim. I think that if you're in a secular context, and I don't know this from experience, but it seems to me that to not hide behind a sort of neutral or objective perspective, but to be able to perhaps present one's own perspective as an example of how one's own cultural values and worldview, if you want to use that term, inform, you know, this is how I have come to this for me. And maybe one way to do that in a context where people are coming from a variety of positions is ask students to do that for themselves. And then there could be kind of a dialogue about that. Because I think Michael's right, or I'm not sure who suggested that, you can't possibly speak to every tradition, but you could have students speak to their own traditions.
Right.
And one of the things that you get then is that people begin to think more explicitly about their, well, whatever you call them, faith commitments, worldview, their underlying assumptions, and that ought to be done in any school. You know, I mean, if you're in a non-sectarian context, doesn't mean you don't have a position. So I think that to surface those things are actually quite valuable, and maybe that's one way to do that.
Right. When I was teaching at Roberts Wesleyan, I had one of my class, I had them write a paper on their own specific worldview and spiritual religious beliefs and how it impacted their understanding of practice. And although the majority of the students were Christian, there were several. There was a Buddhist, and there was one person who identified as very New Age spirituality, and it's actually that student who wrote by far the best paper in the class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, better than any of the Christian students. And, you know, I mean, and it was very good. She identified it as very helpful, and I think it was.
But Ken, do you mind if I play my timekeeper role, Ken?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Rick. I was going to try to do that, but thank you.
I didn't want to, I think, Michael, you were starting to say something. I didn't mean to cut off your thought.
Okay,
maybe finish that thought. I just wanted to make sure for folks who we promised an hour, we didn't go too far over.
And Rick, in case people have to leave, I was wondering if maybe we could make an announcement that for the bulletin board, I know you have a link to the bulletin board, would it be possible for you to resend that link with some instructions as to how to use the bulletin board? Because it would be great to, I was thinking, Jim, your comment a little bit ago about, you know, each of us sort of sharing how this links with our faith traditions. I'd be very interested in that. I've got some Reformed friends. I'd love to, you know, sort of hear your thoughts on that. And the bulletin board might be an ideal way to share those resources.
Yes, I'd be glad to do that. So both the link and instructions, and I'll probably give instructions on the wiki to, well, we can talk more about that piece, but at least so if people want to continue this conversation to know where to do that and how to do that. Great suggestion.
I had one quick question about it. When it says your website and then your email, what if you don't have your own separate website? Do you need one?
We're actually, the bulletin board we're setting up, you shouldn't have to actually start your own account. You should be able to just make an entry without doing that.
Okay, so the guest commenting mode, you don't need to enter your name, website, email.
Right, there's different ways of setting up the bulletin board, but this first one we want to set up so that people don't have to go through a lot of hassle. They can just jump right into conversation.
Okay, so I'm just looking at it right now, and it says your name, and then it has for your website, and then your email. So should we not use this, or should we wait until you send us something different?
Sounds like I need to do a little more legwork. I'll look into it, get some instructions in together, so it's a much simpler process for you to jump in, Michael. Sorry about that.
No, I'm just curious. That's why. So,
in the meantime, let me just suggest this one. Biblicaltheology.ca, all one word. It's got two books about Christian worldview and the story of Scripture, kind of along the lines that Ken was talking about. So if you want to get some stuff there, biblicaltheology.ca.
Great, thank you.
And if I can just finish my thought, when I heard David share that, my thought was that, well, that's because David, that you're a good instructor and you're able to not superimpose your beliefs or biases and so allow students to do that. I really would have concern, at least in my experiences, even at the University of South Carolina, that certain faculty would actually allow me to have the freedom to do that. So that, and so putting myself in the shoes of a student, you know, that Ken's formal response, I'm less hopeful that could happen.
One thought I had there, I've taught some master's courses at Case Western where I did my doctoral work. I've taught as an adjunct there. And Case is a wonderful school, but they really don't have anyone who's even talking much about spirituality, much less religion, and the integration of social work. And so it's a place that is open to those conversations, but doesn't have a lot of them, if that makes sense. And in the course of teaching my classes, both times, I've had, you know, when people found out that I was someone who felt comfortable talking about religion and spirituality in class, I often sort of started off talking about what I do for a living and where I teach, students have actually wanted to have those conversations. And one student in particular that stands out was someone who worked with people who were receiving treatment for a variety of sexual issues and, you know, an advocacy sort of group, I think more than actually a treatment group. And so she talked about how judged her student or her clients had felt by the church and by Christians and sort of said to me, you know, how can you be a Christian and collaborate with us? And so I was actually able in a very shortened version of this to talk a little bit about this idea of the kingdom and that for me, I'm not about excluding people. I'm about trying to, you know, include as many people as possible. And so it wasn't, you know, I didn't have the 20 PowerPoints, but it was sort of a short overview of why for me this works, sort of tying in with some of the other comments that have been made. And, you know, actually this person thanked me, sent me an email later and thanked me again. This is someone who wasn't real open to the Christian faith tradition, but wanted to have dialogue about this, wanted to understand it better. So now that was sort of situational. I don't know that I could plan on that happening again, but I do think there's ways that this might be helpful in a secular context.
This is Jamie. I'm going to have to cut out, but I really appreciate the conversation. Look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Jamie.
Yep, bye.
Ed, I feel bad. We lost you for a bit, and I know that you had prepared some remarks. Would you want to share those with us before we end here?
Well, you know, not a problem. I concur with much of what David was saying. Those of you who were at BPD a few weeks ago and followed some of the discussion concerning EPAS 2008 heard a lot of strong talk about don't modify the core competencies and don't modify the practice behaviors. Just go with it as it is in the book. And I couldn't object more strongly to that viewpoint. The other side of the coin is, however, that it is not an easy thing to add a competency that is somehow distinctively Christian or practice behaviors that are distinctively Christian, and I think the reason for that is that the social work profession has deep roots in the church and in Christianity, not the only roots, but certainly deep roots there, and much of what is practiced in the social work profession is really based on Christian ideas. And so it may be a matter of tweaking the language here and there, adding a practice behavior, talking about additional sources of knowledge that extend beyond a narrow view of science and evidence and so forth, and essentially modifying some of the language so that it's more accommodating to a Christian perspective. And that's about it. I think that David's emphasis on context was an important one, and if you sort through the 10 competencies, or 13 depending on how you count them, and the 41 practice behaviors, I think you will start to see little places that ring bells in terms of how a Christian perspective might be integrated throughout. And I would encourage people to do that.
Right, and my only thing about the separate competency for Christian programs is having to do with the kind of thing specifically that Ken was doing today, helping equip the students, especially the Christian student, to understand how their faith relates, and in a much more significant way, and how it supports and so forth. So. Not that it wouldn't relate and connect throughout to all these other aspects as well. But I think that there's a place for it, certainly on the knowledge and values level, but perhaps to some extent on the practice level, some of these kinds of ways for Christians to understand their faith and to understand how worldviews work, not only theirs but other people's worldviews. And how that relates to practice. So I think I would still make a bit of a case for a separate competency for Christian programs. But in any event, one of the things I want to also mention, just as a resource that for those who are looking forward to the very complicated issue of operationalizing and assessing. On the one hand, you've got the ideal that the reality that we all live in is that social work profession is a long way from actually achieving the reality that the CPAS holds out. And so what's going to be honored by accreditation body is good faith reasonable, plausible approximations as you look at these different competencies and ways to assess them. No one's going to be doing it fully and perfectly all the way across the board or even anywhere on the board. And so keep the ideal in mind, but as you work with your own programs, think about reasonable, plausible approximations of these.
And Dave, is that from you, or is that from basically your sense of the whole committee?
You can take it. You can take it from the. I feel confident. I'm speaking the mind of the commission on this.
Okay.
I think there's understanding of this. And you know, the document that Steve Holloway
yes, that was terrific, yeah.
produced,
yeah.
you know, is a good representation of that. Mm-hmm. Is a former. Chair of the commission and with lots of years of experience at it, you know, and I think that document is a very useful document, which is to say that we're going to be muddling, everyone's going to be muddling through, but what really is important and helpful is to look at it not just as an exercise you have to go through for the commission, mm-hmm. but as a way to help you think through your programs and what you're doing in your programs to really do a better job.
Yeah, I mean, we're 3 years out, and we're meeting every Monday from 9 to 11 as a faculty just to talk about this.
Anyway, I think it's... Yeah. So I think you can turn it into a helpful exercise, even though, you know, like Ed, you have questions about the whole idea of turning it into measurable objectives or competencies. You know, I mean, yes, that is a problem. But on the other hand, this is the world we're living in, and it helps us to get closer to what we're all trying to do. So that would be my little pitch.
Well, it is 1:15. I actually have a meeting with our provost in a few minutes here that I should probably get to.
Yeah.
But I wanted to thank everyone for participating. David and Ed, I especially appreciate your insight and your wisdom as people that are sort of in the forefront with the EPOD, so thank you. And thanks to all of you for participating, and I'll just put another plug in for the bulletin board technology. I think that would be a way that we could continue some of these discussions. I'd love to go further with this and talk some more about this in that format. So thank you all.
Thanks to you too, Ken.
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, all. Take care. Bye-bye. Good weekend.